Is the juice worth the squeeze when it comes to turning your home into a rental instead of selling it when you move? Keep listening to find out. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you had learned in medical school. I'm your host, Justin Harvey, and here is your co-host, who is sleep deprived from being the assistant coach on his son's 12U travel baseball team, Dr. Jimmy Turner.
So for those of you that haven't been introduced to travel baseball, it is this entire thing. I mean, it takes over your life, basically. So for those of you that have not experienced this and you have no interest in baseball, I highly encourage you to keep your kids away from baseball. I'm kind of kidding, but not really. So it's like Saturdays and Sundays, tournaments. You don't know what time the games are going to be until like Thursday of that week. Saturday, it's probably going to be an all-day thing. You might have a 9 o'clock game and a 1 p.m. game, and they take 2 hours. So you're there from 7:30 until 4 p.m. on a Saturday, and then you don't find out what your seed is on Sunday until the games are all finished on Saturday, and you might have another 6 or 7 hours on Sunday. But we also have practices during the week, and you have to get field time whenever you can. And it turns out that some of our field time is late, and I wake up at 4:30 in the morning when I work at the hospital the next day. And I basically had to leave practices early because I need to get sleep, and baseball is just running late again, and it is a total thing. I love coaching, though. It's a highly rewarding experience. Love working with the boys and obviously working with my son. So totally worth it. Definitely sleep deprived sometimes, and I'm able to recover on days like this. So that's always nice.
It sounds like some kind of social experiment where it's like, so you start at 7 and we finish at 5, but what if we start at 5 and finish at 9 and then we start at 6 a.m. the next, like, how far can we push this before finally people are like, I'm not going to sign up for this and pay a lot of money for it?
In the baseball world, it just seems like there is not such a thing. Just schedule it whenever. People will show up because baseball is life. It's like, it reminds me of the soccer show. It's like one of my favorite shows ever at the moment. But we're one of the characters, Ted Lasso, one of the characters is just famous for saying, you know, football is life. And that's how travel baseball is in America. So for those of you who are so inclined. On this show, we're going to talk about what to do with your house when you move. And I think this is a really great question that we have for the show that was sent in, because it applies to fourth-year med students who own a home and are moving for residency and are considering, what do I do with that? Probably more commonly, it applies to residents and fellows that own a home and then are becoming an attending. And what do I do with the home when that happens? And so this is going to be really helpful for anybody. And obviously, everyone listening is pretty likely to probably sell a house at some point during their life and have this thought cross their mind, should I rent this property instead of selling it? So we're going to hammer that out on this episode. Before we do, don't forget, May is Disability Insurance Awareness Month, so make sure that you get disability insurance, in particular, before you finish training. So for those of you that are in residency or fellowship, you have to get disability insurance before you finish training, because 50% of you need a guaranteed standard issue plan due to your medical history. I was in that boat. Unfortunately, I didn't know about it. Nobody told me about it. My program didn't know about it. And that said, the GSI, the guaranteed policy, that is what 50% of doctors need, is only available in training. So every year, 5 months from now, I'm going to get an email from somebody saying, hey, Jimmy, I love your stuff. I realize I need to get disability insurance now. I graduated residency 6 months ago. And what do I do? And they have type 1 diabetes, or they've got a history of anxiety and depression, or their BMI is 40, or they have some orthopedic injury. And I have to tell them, hey, look, for a lot of those cases, you're now uninsurable. You can't get disability insurance at all because you waited and you didn't get it in training. And for others, you're going to have a policy that's going to exclude whatever we know about. And instead, you could have got it in training, gotten the guaranteed policy, and had all those things covered. So please don't forget to make sure to check that box before you leave. MoneyMeetsMedicine.com/disability. You can go there, get a quote, and we'll actually show you how to make it affordable even on a resident budget. It's kind of silly how low we can get it a lot of the time. And you can get all that at MoneyMeetsMedicine.com/disability. So Justin, you want to read the question for this show that we got, and then we'll tackle it?
Yeah. I've been living in my house in northern Georgia for about 3 years while my spouse finishes her surgical residency. I took a job as an attending anesthesiologist at a local academic center during her last year. My spouse is doing a fellowship in New York, where we will be moving next summer. We currently own the home we're living in and are considering whether we should rent the home for extra income or just be done with it and sell it.
So I think this is a great question. And Kristen and I actually dealt with this. So for those that are new to the show, I knew nothing about money until basically my fellowship. And so we decided to buy a house, not before first year of medical school, but after first year of medical school, when I only had 3 years left. I do not recommend that for anybody. It ended up working out for us because I went to medical school at Wake Forest, North Carolina, and then I stayed for residency and for fellowship and stayed on faculty thereafter. And so for us, it panned out because we ended up being in this house for a long time. But we basically bought this house in 2009. And then I graduated fellowship 2017. We paid off our student loans those first 2 years. That was our financial focus. And we bought a house in 2019. So I had this starter home for 10 years that we wanted to move from and buy a house. And it totally crossed my mind at that point, because at this point, I do know something about money. Man, should we hang on to this property and like cash flow this thing, like rent it to some like medical students or residents that are coming into the area and potentially make money from this? Could be another stream of revenue in our life, of income in our life. And ultimately, we decided to sell the house, not do that, after Jimmy Turner did some deep introspective work about who he is as a human being and how real estate maybe doesn't fit into that. But this is such a common question, Justin. So you know, obviously, for everybody, it's going to be a little bit of a different answer in terms of your situation, in terms of your wiring and your DNA and how you think through things. But I don't know. I'm excited to talk about this one.
Yeah. Something that I've seen a lot in the last few years, especially, is I was not privileged to purchase a house back when rates were like very, 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 very low. But I've got a lot of clients that did. And now they have this sort of emotional connection, totally separate from the math and the operational realities of, should I own a single family home that someone else is going to live in and be sort of accountable to that tenant for their domicile? Totally separate from that, they're like, I have a 2.9% 30-year mortgage and I am going to have to leave that if I sell my home. And that makes me very, very sad. So it's kind of like a golden handcuff situation. And I get it, because yeah, you're probably never going to see a mortgage rate that's less than inflation ever again. Yep. And that's a bummer. And yeah, you probably should have bought your forever home back then, but here we are today. And now you know what you know, and we're going to have to just move forward. So that's another dynamic that especially folks asking this question right now, if you've refinanced in the last handful of years, this is something that makes it a little extra spicy for you.
I agree. And being an owner that has a 3% interest rate on his house, I totally relate to that. It would be very hard for me to move from this home. Granted, we love this area and my kids are in school at this point, so that's not going to happen anyway. But that's it. I think this is an interesting question for another reason too. And because most people, they think very simply through this problem, like, oh, cash flow, it's $500 a month. Or actually, they're probably thinking about the mortgage. Like, this is $2,000 a month is coming into my life. And you don't have to think about it. You still actually have to pay the mortgage, right? So maybe your cash flow is a few $100. But from their standpoint, extra income, extra revenue coming into my world, that's a good thing. Diversifying income streams, that's a good thing. And then you don't realize that on the back end of that, what you're really doing is becoming an accidental landlord. And that's probably the way you should be thinking through this, is from the standpoint of, in some ways, being a business owner, you now own a home that someone else is living in. And to your point earlier, Justin, like, that comes with certain responsibilities. And so for this couple deciding whether the Georgia house is still a home that they plan to move back to, is it an investment? Are they having a hard time because of the low interest rate and the emotional attachment to that? Really figuring out, what exactly are we talking about here when you say you're not going to sell the home and you're going to rent it to somebody? Is that because it's going to become a rental property from here on out? Or is this just a place and time where you plan to come back to the area and you're going to move back to that house after you get done? Deciding what exactly the purpose of that move is, I think, is obviously the first thing we need to talk about.
Yeah. And especially like if you're in Georgia and you're going to New York, those are pretty different, especially Northern Georgia, if you're non-Atlanta. And so maybe you're not going to want to stay in New York. And so it could be just a temporary thing. I think another factor that I've heard from clients is that there's this idea, and Jimmy, this is a sort of well-trodden territory for you and I on the show, is that real estate, it's the thing that's going to get me where I want to go. Yes.
Panacea.
Yes. Totally. Just the concept of it is this thing I should be participating. I need to have exposure to this asset class, this thing that's like, if I'm going to be 10 years from now sitting on my couch and money is going to be just printing all around me, then real estate is the way I'm going to get there. And a couple times I've had this conversation, I just want to be there with real estate doing the passive income thing. And in this case, I was like, well, let's look at the math. And at this point, I know enough to know, you know, I'm now into my latter 30s. And I know that you don't tell people, you just hold up the numbers and ask what they think. So I'm at the point now in my career where I know, I understand the diplomacy required to help someone come to their own conclusion, do the inception, Christopher Nolan, like, I can't tell you what to do. I'm just going to go three levels down into your consciousness and plant that little seed and then allow you to come to your own conclusion. And if your mortgage is $7,000 a month and you can get $5,000 a month for rent, and you're telling me this is an investment property that's going to be part of your passive wealth building scheme, like, let's think about this. You're paying $7,000 every month. You're getting $5,000. So you're literally cutting a check for an additional $2,000 from your checking account every month, in addition to maintenance, in addition to, God forbid, something big happens. What kind of investment does that sound like? Does it sound like a good investment or a bad investment? And often, you know, like, my clients are smart people. They're not stupid, but sometimes they don't have an opportunity to think these things all the way through. And so when this math is held up to them and when we talk it through, it's like, oh my gosh, like, this is actually a really obvious decision. And I'm glad we're having this conversation. And I could have easily just done this thinking, this is an investment. This is how real estate investing in air quotes works. And you just do what you got to do in order to have that holy grail thing in your life. But turns out the numbers matter and the net cash flows matter. And $7,000 a month mortgage, you probably need 9 or 10 of rent for that to be worth it. And if your market doesn't support that, then we should just cash out and keep it moving.
Before we get back to it, let's talk taxes. As many of you know, I recently took a 1099 private practice gig as an anesthesiologist after being a W-2 doc for 15 years. And honestly, after combining this with the business income from Money Meets Medicine, the tax piece almost broke me. Should I be an S-Corp? What about QBI deductions or the pass-through entity tax breaks I should be taking advantage of? Nobody really teaches this stuff in residency. You just kind of figure it out after you've already screwed it up. That's why I started working with Gelt for proactive tax planning for my own taxes. Gelt is a modern CPA firm that specializes in helping high-earning physicians. So whether you're a locums doc, a practice owner, a partner getting a K-1, or a W-2 physician with 1099 income on the side, Gelt handles the stuff that actually moves the needle. S-Corp elections, PTET credits, QBI, retirement optimization, really everything in between. The biggest reason I started working with Gelt myself is that, unlike most CPA firms, they provide a proactive strategy all year long, not just an intake form and running the numbers in February or March each year. So if your CPA only reached out in February or March and left you wondering if you paid more on taxes than you should, it doesn't have to be that way. A great CPA is a year-round partner who knows your business and reaches out proactively. And Q2 is the best time to make a switch because Gelt specializes in exactly this kind of transition for those of you who are ready for a better experience. Speaking of which, when new clients get started this quarter, Gelt goes back through your last 3 years of returns and identifies deductions that were missed, and in some cases is able to recover them. This is included as a complimentary service for new clients. So if your tax situation has outgrown TurboTax or your current CPA only calls you in March each year, head over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA for a free consult with Gelt. And because you're a part of the Money Meets Medicine community, when you use that link, you'll also get a 10% discount off services with Gelt that first year as well. So head on over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA and check out Gelt. I couldn't agree more. And it actually reminds me of the quote, the art of negotiation, right? Is letting someone else have your way. And we've talked before a lot on the show about the way that you frame things to yourself and to other people will fundamentally impact the decision. And so if you're framing this as extra cash flow, extra revenue, extra income coming into my life, that's framed very positively. If you are framing it in terms of, let's consider those numbers in light of all of these other numbers that matter, like, who's going to manage the property? Are you going to pay 8 to 10% to a property manager to manage the house? You still have to foot the cost for a lot of things that come up, but there goes 10% of your potential cash flow every single month because you're paying it to someone else. And you might not have any income now. It might be the fact that they're paying basically your mortgage and there's no extra money coming to you. And things do happen. Like, if you've owned a house, I got a funny story. That's not inappropriate. It's life. It happened. So I was coming home from work the other day. I was about to leave the hospital and my son calls me. And it's on FaceTime. Hey, Dad. I was like, what's up, buddy? He's like, I think you need to see this. I'm like, great. This is awesome. I'm already like, I didn't have the best day. I was already kind of in a grumpy mood, to be honest. And he flips the camera around and my dogs happen to get Giardia or like some GI bug of some kind. And my carpet in my master bedroom looks like a Jackson Pollock scene. And it's been there for a long time. So I'm already in my grumpy mood. And I come home very quickly determined that there's no way to salvage the situation. So I go get a box cutter and I cut up all the carpet in my master bedroom where all of the stuff was. And then my wife the next day is having a conversation with somebody about putting composite wood in our master bedroom, which it needed to be replaced at some point, but it was $4,500, right? It's $4,500. And that came out of nowhere. Like, before that phone call, I didn't have to spend $4,500. And then after that phone call, it became very obvious that I needed to do something about the floor in my master bedroom. And so that's the sort of stuff that comes up when you're owning a home. I know it's a funny story, right?
Appreciate canines, and I like to appreciate them from afar in moments like this.
I'm not going to lie. We're big animal people. Got 2 dogs, 3 cats, a rabbit. And after recent experiences with my 2 German shepherds, they may be the last two dogs I own. The ridiculousness of the expenses that have come out of these two furry children is quite high, and we love them dearly, but my stages of owning a dog may soon be over.
That's why you want to think about the pet clause in your rental agreement at minimum.
That's true. That's something that you need to think about because
and
you
have
that
hardwood or vinyl floor literally everywhere.
Yep. Yep. Much easier to clean. But my point is that, you know, they come up with rules of thumb for stuff like just everything in personal finance. And it's 10% of your home cost is going to be what it costs, you know, to maintain your home. Or what is it? 1% of your 1%. Home cost, what it costs to maintain your home. So you have a $500,000 house. You just should bake it into the calculations. You're going to be spending $5,000 to repair something, an air conditioner, your dog's Jackson Pollock scene in your master bedroom, whatever it might be in your specific situation. But you start baking in those numbers in addition to all the income and revenue and the good side of things. And it does change the math. Something else that changes the math too, maybe I'll let you talk about this, Justin, because you have more experience with this than I do, is the Section 121 and whether something's considered your primary residence. Because I think this is something that most people do not think about, and it's highly applicable to physicians in particular.
Yes. Yeah. So basically the IRS gives you free capital gains on your primary residence for $250,000 per taxpayer. So it's $250,000 if you own something individually, and if you own it jointly, it's $500,000. So especially for the kinds of homes that physicians would purchase based on their income, it's not at all hard to use a lot of that or all of that. You know, if you buy a $1 million house a few years ago. Jimmy, I'm talking to people right now. I've got a few clients who are on the hunt to try to find properties, and we're looking at these homes, and right now it's listed for 2.4, and like 18 months ago, it was listed for like 1.6. This I'm thinking about in like the New York sprawl in particular. And there's just so much pressure on the market that you can easily burn through that entire exclusion. So it's a really good thing to have, and you don't have to pay capital gains on anything in that $500,000.
So we live in North Carolina, which is the opposite of that. Low cost living place. Bought a house in 2019. I easily have $500,000 of equity in our house now that we bought for $450,000 7 years ago.
Yeah, that's another state. I mean, I see a lot of people moving to North Carolina. It's one of those places that seems to be attractive. There's big businesses that are putting footprint there and things. But as it relates to the topic at hand here, understanding this rule and in what cases am I going to get this? You get a little bit of a free look in terms of the rental. So you got to live in the house 2 out of the last 5 years in order to have access to this free capital gain. So if I buy a house for $500,000 as a PGY1, and then I'm a PGY4 slash attending and my wife is doing her surgical residency, the house has gone from $500,000 to $1 million. I can sell this house for $1 million and bank that $500,000 of profit, and that just goes into my checking account. If I get to $1.1 million and I have $600,000 of profit, that last $100,000 is going to be a capital gain on which I'm going to pay taxes. But if we think about this listener's example, and I move to New York and I think, you know what, I might want to come back to Georgia because all my family's here. So I like the idea of renting this. Maybe I'm not making a ton of money, but I can at least not have to pay the mortgage in an empty house. So I'm going to rent it to somebody who's going to cover costs for 12 months and see what happens. And then as it happens, you know, like you're doing residence or you're doing fellowship. And as soon as you get there, you're getting pressured by practices to commit to an attending job. So there's an opportunity there to say, we're going to be gone for a year. Or even if we sort of stress test it a little bit, maybe you're going to take a year at a private practice in New York or at any opportunity in New York and like see what happens and continue to rent out that house. But you're starting the clock once you leave.
That's right.
So yeah, you can rent it for 1 year or you can rent it for 2 years. But once you rent it for 3 years, you're at the brink of when you're going to get that free capital gain exclusion. And now you go from year 3 to 4. Now you've only been in the house for 1 out of the last 5 years. And you go from $100,000 of capital gain to $600,000 of capital gain. And that's going to be a six-figure tax delta, most likely. So this is something you want to mind in terms of the timing of everything and your tax domicile and the dates you move. This is all like the devil's in the details. It all matters. So make sure you're closely monitoring these things. You definitely should be working with the CPA to help you navigate this. But there is opportunity and there is a little free look. And if you do that fellowship, and your wife is like, oh my gosh, the big city, the bright lights, I can't take it. Let's go back home to where all the family is, where there's the rolling green fields of Northern Georgia. Great. You can do it. You can come back. And I mean, you can move back into the house, or that's probably the scenario here that it sounds like the listeners would be interested in. But you could also let that person rent for another year or so and then sell it and still keep the entirety of those gains tax-free, at least the first half a million.
So the one reason why I like talking about this is because it comes across as a black and white question. Like, it's an either or. It's a bit of a false dichotomy where it's like, hey, we could sell the house and make our half a million and not pay taxes on a single dollar of it. Or we could rent it out, and 3 years from now, if we go to sell it, we're going to owe taxes on the entire six-figure sum, and it's going to be a very, very large tax bill. And there is that in between. If this person's going to fellowship in New York for that year and you want to try out what it's like to be a landlord for a year because you're just curious if it would make sense to you, I would argue this is maybe the best way to do it, because if you buy an actual rental property, the taxes are handled very differently, and you might buy a property, figure out after a year you hate being a landlord, and guess what? You now have to come up with 8% of the house's cost to sell it a year later, which you're probably not going to have that equity in the home. That's not a great way to find that out. And so if you have an interest, I would say, hey, this is an interesting trial phase, but you need to make sure you make your decision about whether you're going to be continuing to be a landlord or not by year three, because then all of a sudden you do owe taxes on the full 600 instead of just the first 500. And that is a very, very big deal. This brings up another point: taxes in general on real estate. I know you've mentioned this on the podcast before, Justin, but I think this is something that gets swept under the rug because real estate is the panacea in the personal finance space for physicians. Everybody gets pitched syndications or different real estate courses and how short-term rental loopholes and all that stuff. I think it's important to drill home the fact that at some point outside of this Section 121 situation where it's your primary residence, like, you're going to have to pay the piper at some point. And I feel like that doesn't get talked about enough. Where
unless you die with it.
So, and that was going to be my point, right? You can use forced depreciation and cost segregation analysis and all these other advanced tax techniques to lower your tax burden right now. But unless you die with that property and or 1031 exchange into other properties until the day you die, at some point, taxes will be owed. And so that's why, as I'm thinking through this out loud, if you're ever going to consider being a landlord, maybe this is a situation where you try it, because you don't have to deal with so many of those other issues of buying an actual property that come with that, and that forced depreciation, your cost segregation analysis. Like, now you've got this property and a year later you realize you hate being a landlord. You don't like management companies. This is just not the thing for you. And it brings into different financial considerations. And so that said, all of these amazing tax techniques people talk about, you will owe the tax at some point unless you decide to be a landlord or a real estate aficionado for the rest of your life. And as someone who changes interests about every 3 to 5 years, as my friends and family would tell you, that is not a wise decision for me personally, yeah. But maybe you're wired differently.
Yeah. And just thinking about your own life, and like, have you ever had a time when something that was so central to what you thought was important, and I'm not talking about like a core value, maybe it is, but I'm talking about like a thing that I could never imagine life without this. It's an important part of being in my 20s or being in my 30s or being in my 40s, and life up to this point, it just makes sense to fill in the blank. Does it make sense when you're 50, 60, 70? Does it make sense when you're 74, when you're 81, when you're like, all I care about is my grandkids, and anything that has nothing to do with my grandkids, I want to rip out of my life because it's too complicated, and I just want to go to their t-ball games, and I want to drink coffee on my front porch, and I want to take it easy. But now I have a real estate portfolio, and I actually have a client like this. Like, I've got 10 houses, I got a bunch of embedded gains, and I have this implicit pressure to maintain all these properties and die with them so that I don't have to pay the taxes. But also, if you have 10 properties, I would surmise what this person wants in the conversations that I've had is like, I just want to turn all these properties into a big pile of cash and live on that pile of cash and sip coffee on my front porch. And you can't do that if you're going to die with it. So there are solutions. But to think at 40 or 45 that you're going to make a decision that's going to last for 45 years, like, it's hard to do.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe this brings into question for this listener that's brought this in. Dual physician couple, how much is this going to move the needle for you? Because that's the other question, right? When you're probably clearing close to $1 million a year between a surgeon and an anesthesiologist, and you've got this rental property that's bringing in $2,500 a month, of which $500 is actual profit, is that $6,000 a year worth it to deal with the phone calls about the issues at the property, whether that's from the management company or directly from the tenant, depends on how you want to manage it. Is it really worth it? And for me, that's kind of where I started to get to on things. Like, there's a reason why I pay people to do things in my life that I otherwise could do. And that's because it saves me time. And so when I have other things come up that are potential asks on my time, I make evaluation about, is this worth it for me based on my values, based on my goals, based on my interests? There are certain things that I would do, like coach a 12U baseball team and not get paid, because I just really like to do it. Has it taken over my life? Absolutely. Do I love doing it? Yes, to be honest, I do. And so I do that for free, right? And it's several hours of my week, every single week. That said, there are some things that you could not pay me enough to do. Like, you could give me an infinite paycheck and I would probably tell you I'm just not interested in doing that. And so you have to decide, what does your priority list look like? What are your tendencies as a person? Do you like the idea of being a landlord? How does that fit into your world? Is the financial number that we're talking about going to move the needle for you based on your financial situation? Or is this a place that, hey, I want someone to rent it for a year because I want to try out being a landlord because we plan on moving back to Georgia and we're going to move back into that house until we find a house that we're going to build? That sounds like a great idea, right? If you know you're going to New York for 12 months, you want to rent it, you want to come back, and you know a year later you're going to sell it, you want to take advantage of the Section 121, get your $500,000 out of the house, and then while you're building your other house and do that, that sounds like a phenomenal plan, right? So it just depends on so many things. But I think a lot of people I experience, at least, and that's because I'm not a huge real estate aficionado, once they really think about it, they don't love the idea of being a landlord. But for some, it's like they love it. It's just their thing. It's what they do. Part of their identity.
Yes. Personal finance, personal. That's all I was going to say. Just like, this is one of those areas where knowing yourself goes a long way. And the numbers help and the concepts are interesting, but what do you want the fabric of your life to be actually comprised of? And do rental properties, especially in far-flung states, fit into that picture? It's a good question to honestly ask yourself.
Couldn't agree more. So if you have questions of your own that you want answered on the show, email jimmy@moneymeetsmedicine.com. Happy to take a look at the questions that you have and bring them on the show, which we often do. And as you head out, don't forget Disability Insurance Awareness Month. Really important to make sure you have disability insurance. Number one financial task for physicians, because all this stuff we talked about on the show about investing in real estate, that can't happen if you lose your income. So go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability and we will be more than happy to get your quote. Everyone, we'll see you next week. Cheers.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.